from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Being seen as a late bloomer was once a mark of vitality, patience, and pluck. That's according to Rich Carlgaard, who is an entrepreneur, journalist, and publisher of Forbes. But nowadays, amid a cultural obsession with achievement that begins as kids enter preschool, he says being a late bloomer is considered a defect. Carlgaard, a self-proclaimed late bloomer who says he barely got through college, joins us to talk about the advantages of coming into one's own later in life, and his new book, Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. That's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Forbes is known for its annual 30 Under 30 lists, which highlight the achievements of young, bold entrepreneurs around the world. But the magazine's publisher, Rich Carlgaard, says that at age 25, he could barely handle his job as a security guard at a trucking yard. Rich Carlgaard joins us this hour to talk about social pressures to succeed when you're young, the unsung benefits of coming into ourselves later in life, and his new book, Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Welcome, Rich.
Honored to be here, Michael.
Good to have you. Well, this is nothing short of a manifesto. It's a call for a bloomer revolution, really. And let's talk about why. I mean, obviously, for one thing, people are living longer and technology is advancing. But it has to do also with the need, because of all that, to reinvent ourselves.
Well, it does. But I called for a manifesto and a revolution, really, to address challenges all throughout our lifetimes. If you look at the pressures that young kids are going through today, particularly if they have aspirational, professionally educated parents, they live in Silicon Valley, they live in San Francisco or Seattle or communities like that, we're putting so much pressure on kids to be these stratospheric test scorers and straight-A students in advanced placement courses. And some kids will thrive doing that, and they're natural early bloomers. But many will not and are suffering terribly because of it, with rising rates of depression, anxiety, even suicides among people that age.
Even a new report that just came out within the last day or so about the Generation X and suicides and depression, the numbers are really scary and, in fact, terrifying. We're talking here also about something that ties in with the fact that, you've got some data, and you've got some important data about brain development and all the rest of these things, but the peak innovation age is late in the 40s. We have pretty much support of that, more Nobels, more patents, more success stories than ever before.
Well, even in Silicon Valley there, which probably is as guilty of ageism as any working area in the country, when you really examine who are the people that are succeeding in Silicon Valley, you see people are succeeding all along the age spectrum, not just at the early, not just in their 20s. I think we get that impression because of these super early achievers like Mark Zuckerberg or Sergey Brin and Larry Page, the two founders of Google. But you have people like David Duffield, who founded Workday at 46, and PeopleSoft at 46 and Workday at 64. Or Tom Siebel, who's running C3 AI in his late 60s. So the myth of Silicon Valley being the a place where only young people can accomplish things is just that, a myth.
In fact, the average age of entrepreneurship is 47, although people are getting, like you said, there's a lot of age discrimination in Silicon Valley. We won't go there, though. What I really want to talk to you about, though, is this manifesto of yours would open up more opportunities and would make it we're talking about an ideal world here, but there's such great resources of older people and the way they could be used in the economy.
Yes. One of the breakthrough studies that I came across was a 2015 study led by Laura Germine at Harvard and Joshua Hartshorn at MIT. And they're both postdoc students at Mass General Hospital. And they asked a seemingly simple question: at what age do we cognitively peak? And the answer turned out to be far more complex, intriguing, and ultimately hopeful than probably they even thought. And the answer depends on what cognitive ability are you talking about. If you're talking about rapid algorithmic skills, the kind of skills that make you a really good software programmer under a time pressure, or maybe a high-frequency trader on Wall Street, sure enough, those peak in our teens and 20s. But when you look at all the neurological functions that support executive functioning, wisdom, communication skills, leadership skills. These are neurological attributes that really only come into their own in our 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond.
So we're doing harm to our younger people with all these high achievement bars that we have in our culture.
Well, I think we are. Now, the ones that are thriving that are getting over that bar and thriving, God bless them. You know, there are nature's early prodigies, Mozart, some of the people that I've already mentioned, people like Mark Zuckerberg or Sergey Brin and Larry Page. The mistake is thinking that everybody is wired that way. And if we've designed a school system such as we have that puts excess value on standardized tests and getting high grades in advanced placement courses, that will reward people who are naturally gifted in that way. And it's going to punish kids who are not naturally wired that way. In fact, it'll make them feel depressed and inferior. And that's really the heart of the manifesto of late bloomers.
There's also a kind of paradox here. I mean, since you're the publisher of Forbes and you have this under 30 thing that comes out all the time, right? You're giving a great deal of, shall we say, support to the idea that there are all these young high achievers.
Yes. Randall Lane, the editor of Forbes, came up with a brilliant idea of the 30 under 30 list. Now, it's a franchise within Forbes called our U30 conferences. We have them in the U.S. and Tel Aviv and in London, all around the world. And I think what he did was really terrific. I feel like that as a late bloomer myself, it's up to late bloomers like myself to make the argument for the other side, not to diminish the early bloomers, but to say at this moment in time, maybe there's too much cultural weight on the early pressures to succeed side. Let's talk about the other side. Let's talk about the neuroscience and the psychology, and let's give some inspiring examples of people who've achieved later.
So you're going to have a new thing in Forbes now, over 60 high achievers, stories well, along those lines?
Word up to me, but, you know, advertising likes young people.
Well, indeed they do, and that's part of the problem. I mean, the whole youth culture is something that we could certainly analyze and talk about to a great deal, but I want your personal story because you bring that into the book. You were a student at Stanford. You had roommates who went on to, well, reasonable success after college. It took you a little longer. In fact, you say you got in on a fluke. I'd like to hear that part of the story for our listeners' sake, but there's something very funny in this. You're working as a security guard. You realize that your colleague is a Rottweiler that's over in the other yard as a security guard, and you think, is this all there is for me? Suddenly, things happen, though, and really happen because of a Macintosh. Apple Macintosh, right?
The Apple Macintosh. Yeah, back to when I was a security guard in the Rottweiler, I was 25 years old when I had that realization that I was doing the same job as a dog in the trucking yard next door. And a couple of months after that, Steve Jobs, also 25, took Apple public. I did get into Stanford on a fluke. Let's just say in the 1970s, it was a far easier institution to get into than now. As near as I can tell, the rates of acceptance were around 25%. And probably more from junior college transfers from small states like North Dakota, where I was from. And I was a runner, and I was just a good enough runner to fill a non-scholarship role at the tail end of the cross-country team. And all of that led to me getting into Stanford. Of course, it was too hard for me. And I remember walking to the library with my roommate that would eventually go on and have a fabulous legal career in Silicon Valley. And he would study for hours at a time. And I would fidget after 15 or 30 minutes, and I would go into the library and read hardbound copies of magazines. My favorite magazine at the time was Sports Illustrated. So I like to say I majored in Sports Illustrated, but of course it did me no good on my grades. I barely graduated with a minimum number of credits. And while my roommates were off doing, you know, wonderful things in grad school, I was off being a dishwasher and a security guard. What happened was is that all that reading was Sports Illustrated was learning that I didn't know it was learning. I thought it was goofing off at the time. And so if you fast forward a dozen years, a friend of mine and I, at the dawn of the desktop publishing era, a Macintosh and a laser printer basically, we started what became known as Silicon Valley's first business magazine. My partner raised the money and sold the ads, and I had to come up with a design and feel for the magazine. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be really cool if a business magazine had the same punch and attitude and comic zestiness as Sports Illustrated did. after all, business is competitive, sports is competitive. Why couldn't we do that? We called the
magazine.
You didn't
think about a swimsuit competition.
No. In fact, we didn't have money for photography. That was the big difference. And I found an illustrator in Portland, Oregon, who would draw these withering caricatures of people like Scott McNeely and Larry Ellison, the reigning Silicon Valley gods at the time. We called our magazine Upside. We got a ton of attention for it. And 3 years later, Steve Forbes came out to Silicon Valley with an eye of buying Upside. But we were a wreck financially, and he hired me instead.
And this is a success story. Now, certainly made your name as a pilot and as an author and columnist. And it's a story, and a story that you can get many examples of. For example, you write about Bill Walsh not being a head coach until he was 45, Colonel Sanders not really getting the chicken business going until he was 65, Julia Child, I don't think, started cooking until she was in her late 30s. There are wonderful examples of this. I was particularly struck by authors because some of the greatest authors really made their names as young authors and then kind of pooped out in their early 20s, in fact. But you talk about people like Frank McCourt, of Angela's Ashes, and others like Daniel Brown, The Boys in the Boat, J.K. Rowling, for that matter. These are all late bloomers. So you've got examples in almost every field, really.
Well, I'd like to talk about Daniel J. Brown, not the thriller novelist Dan Brown, but the guy who wrote The Boys in the Boat about the 1936 Olympic eight-man rowing team that a bunch of Depression-era kids that went to the University of Washington, had a very unorthodox coach, very unorthodox boat builder. Somehow they won the national championship against all these aristocratic schools, Ivy League schools, and the military academies. And then they went as a unit to the 36 Olympics. They beat Germany right under Hitler's nose. And Daniel J. Brown began that book in his late 50s and completed it in his early 60s. And he said that I could not have written this book at any earlier in age. And by that he meant he could have gotten the top storyline, but he didn't see the texture of it all. And the texture of it all was the best rower on the team was a kid who grew up in a family so poor, he was kicked out of his house at age 12. There wasn't enough food in the house, and he had to fend for his own. And so this young man had serious trust issues. And the whole thing about a rowing team is getting in what they call the swing. They have to be part of the team. So that was the subtext that Brown only saw as an older, more mature man, and he credits his age and wisdom for being able to write a book that was on the New York Times bestseller list for 2 years.
Talking to Rich Karlgaard, his book is called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a world obsessed with early achievement. And we're going to go to your calls shortly, but I want to go first to education because there's a lot in this manifesto, as I call it, of his book and everything.
You know, I originally was going to call it the Late Bloomers
Manifesto. Really? Yeah.
I'm glad you see that, Michael.
Well, there's a sense also of education, well, advocacy, I suppose, in different areas that have come out before from other authors and so forth. But, I mean, you're a big advocate of community colleges in terms of late blooming, but also of high innovative learning, of learning online, of those kinds of things. What I was most struck by, though, was the gap idea, and this has come up time and again. It certainly allows for late bloomers to a greater extent if you have just almost de rigueur, you got a couple of years of a gap.
Well, think about this. At 18, we're considered legally adults, and yet we know that the prefrontal cortex of our brain isn't fully developed until somewhere around our mid-20s. There are some people like Elkan and Goldberg of NYU who believe it's occurring a little bit later with each generation, but we're not fully recognizable adults, most of us, until our mid-20s and some later than that. So the idea of a gap year, that you take 2 years off, let's say after high school, before college, or commonly after the sophomore year, before the junior year, means that you will be 24 instead of 22 when you graduate from college. That's a big difference at that age. And it almost doesn't matter what you do during the gap year. About the only thing you can do wrong is have your parents write checks and support you on an extended party. But doing mission work, the Church of Latter-day Saints, I'm not a member of the church, but I'm an admirer of the two-year Mormon mission. Would I want to go on one? No.
Not from what I... It's a great idea to have civil service and get that experience.
Civil service. Yeah. A controversial subject would be national service. A lot of people are opposed to the draft, but when you look at nations that have it, like Israel and Singapore and Sweden, Switzerland, they tend to produce young adults that have with much lower rates of drinking and crime.
And colleges, and here we're probably on the same team, not for everybody. So maybe we should have more trade schools, more shop classes, those kinds of things.
Oh, my goodness. You know, only one out of 20 public high schools today has skilled trades, or what they called back in my day, shop class. And I want to tell you a story about one of my college roommates who went off to be a clinical psychologist in Pasadena. And he sees a lot of families, and oftentimes what brings families in is a teenager who's not functioning well, more often a boy than a girl. And Jeff said, this is a very, my old roommate said, this is a very typical story. The teenage boy is having problems in school, and they're hanging out with people the parents don't recognize. My old roommate will have a discussion with the kid, and an example he used is where he found out the kid loved to repair cars. But this kid came from an aspirational upper-middle-class family in Pasadena, and when my old roommate told the parents, you know, maybe this kid shouldn't go to college right away, doesn't mean that he can't go to college someday, but he really likes working on cars. The dad pounded the table and said, my son's going to USC, I went to USC, that's what we do. How is that serving the kid? You know, the kid might go... Going to a skilled trade doesn't mean you always have to be a skilled tradesperson, but it also means, you know, you might have the opportunity, your entrepreneurial gene might bloom, and you might become an owner of shops. And so there are so many ways, you know, people come into this world with so many different kinds of gifts and such a large range of gifts. And if we're only valuing gifts along a very narrow spectrum, as I think we've stumbled into today, it's disastrous.
Brings up another point that you bring up, which is with all the emphasis on STEM and on coding and all the rest of it, it leaves out so much in a liberal arts education that can be valuable and enhancing and actually, in many instances, not enough, in my judgment, possibly lead to different kinds of careers. You've also got the problem of artificial intelligence with all the, I think you point this out, don't you, with all these young people learning code and STEM, AI is around the corner, it's on the horizon.
Yeah, we might be herding all these STEM graduates or some significant percentage of them into a corral where they're going to lose their jobs, victims of the AI revolution. Look, Fortune magazine, not Forbes, my magazine, Fortune, in its 2017 Best Places to Work issue, asked some really high-profile Silicon Valley CEOs, what do you value most in your employees? They asked the CEO of Intuit, the CEO of Genentech. And you know what the number one capability that came up was? It was curiosity. And nobody mentioned where you went to school. Nobody mentioned your SAT scores, anything like that. They talked about curiosity, compassion, resilience. A lot of these are attributes that will develop later. They can develop earlier if given half a chance.
These are what you call your six main attributes, and they're right in the book, and they're kind of a centerpiece of the book. But let me push back a little on this, because, I mean, all these things are very important for success, no doubt about it, especially curiosity, in my judgment, compassion, persistence, equanimity, resilience, wisdom. I think I've covered them all just now. But the problem is, where do you get metrics in this? The metrics are there with SAT scores. The metrics are there with perhaps to some extent what school is graduated from and so forth. These things are subjective.
Well, they are subjective, and that's why they're doubted. We live in an age where data is becoming more and more important. I think it harkens back to the early part of the 20th century when people like Lewis Terman, the psychologist at Stanford, had an idea that what could be measured was valuable. Frederick Taylor, you know, who developed the theory behind the assembly line, what could be measured would be valuable. In the future, he said that the individual won't matter as much as the system. Well, Frederick Terman, of course, who imported the Binet IQ test from 1905 into the United States and adapted it in what was called the Stanford Binet test in 1916, was undone by his own longitudinal study in which, you know, the Stanford study of the gifted, which longitudinal studies followed people throughout their lives, and the people who got the high IQ scores turned out to regress into the mean of their socioeconomic class over the course of their lifetime. So they could measure it, but what did it tell them? It told them nothing of significance.
Well, no, I recognize that, and that's an important point, but what about recognizing or being able to measure these kind of traits that you're talking about? It's very, you have an hour interview, for example, and can you really find out about how authentically compassionate someone is, or how persistent, or for that matter, how curious they are?
Well, you know, somebody who's just even slightly sociopathic could probably learn how to game all of those things. If you asked Elizabeth Holmes, you know, if she was compassionate, she probably would have come up with
She came off as very compassionate. Yeah. She says, you're going to help all these people in Africa.
No, it's a gut call. These late bloomer attributes like curiosity, compassion, resilience, equanimity, wisdom reveal themselves. They're revealed.
Over time.
They're revealed over time.
Yeah. In the meantime, we got SAT scores. But let me go to the invitation to you, our listeners, to join this conversation. We're talking to Rich Karlgaard. He's publisher and columnist with Forbes magazine. He's got a new book out called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. We do want to hear from you. Did you benefit from peaking later in life, or are you feeling washed up at 40? Please share your experiences. We invite your calls now, and our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement, so please join the program. 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Tom writes a correction here. Bill Walsh was born in 1931. He was hired as 49ers head coach. In 1979, he was 47 going on 48. And that, I believe, was his first head coach job.
Well, he was a head coach at Stanford for 2 years,
right.
in 1977 and 1978. In 1966, Bill Walsh was a head coach of the team you've never heard of, the semi-professional San Jose Apaches,
right.
And they practiced on a lumpy high school field, and they played its games at San Jose City College against well-known teams like the Eugene Oregon Bombers.
The point is still taken, though. It was late blooming for Bill Walsh, among so many others. Let's get into a little bit. We're coming up on a break here, but I want to get into the brain stuff in this because you've done a lot of research, and I think it's important research. You talked about the brain development. It's not even really mature until perhaps mid-20s or early 20s, but this idea of rebooting with the brain gets into all kinds of neurological evidence for late blooming. Talk about that.
Well, yes. One study, of course, is that Germain Hartshorne study, the MIT Harvard study that I talked about, that looked at what age do we cognitively peak, and it depends on the cognitive abilities. So in terms of language, for example, we peak in our 60s and 70s, which means we have great careers ahead of us, Michael, because we're in the communication business. But one of my favorite maverick neuroscientist that I talked to, and he's regarded as a maverick, and his theories are a bit controversial. He's named Elkanah Goldberg, NYU. And Elkanah Goldberg started noticing in his late 60s, he's now in his 70s, that he was having flashes of intuition that were as accurate as when he followed a more rigorous logical process to think through a problem. And so his theory is that the two hemispheres of the brain are constantly developing these networks, and basically intuition is an adjudication, a communication between the two sides of our brain.
Yeah, this is fascinating stuff. And again, we're talking with Rich Karlgaard. His new book is called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. The key to this may be patience after all, really a virtue indeed. We'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Rich Karlgaard. He's here with us in studio. He's publisher and columnist for Forbes magazine and has a new book out called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. And indeed, it makes the point that not only is patience a virtue, but it really is not at all overrated as a virtue. The tortoise wins a race and all of that. And just a couple of statistics here that may be of interest to you. According to U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, age is cited in 26% of total complaints in the state of California. And in one study, 45% of older job seekers, ages 55 and older, were long-term unemployed, that is, out of work for 27 weeks or more. So if we're talking about, as I've alluded to in a manifesto here, it's a way to not only have more older people or in the stages of older life involved in the workforce, but recognize that they indeed are a great resource. And we're also talking about many things related to this, and we do want to hear from you. So let me read a couple comments first before I go to your calls. Jake writes, my dad was still inventing and getting new patents in his late 60s. Older people don't lose any of their creativity. What they lose is the serendipity afforded by having excess neurons. And here's a listener who writes, as highly educated parents who have 30-somethings still finding their way, it's important to keep faith in the path they are on. Part of the challenge is to respect their diversions and to help them find the value that can be gleaned in each of these, but it is a challenge. This is so embedded in the culture, though, Rich. You know, you have people who are working on things and they're in their 30s and they're in their 40s and they become almost objects of ridicule, you know, because they haven't done it earlier. And this is a real impediment because they could be doing things that really, well, match not necessarily the early stages of their life and really could bring success. In fact, don't you point out in your book that late bloomers are happier?
Well, late bloomers, let me define what I think late blooming is, because there is no clinical definition of it. In fact, when it comes up in the medical literature, it usually comes up as some kind of a dysfunction or other. Late blooming, as I define it, is when your deepest talents, passions, and sense of purpose are in alignment, and you feel literally that you're blossoming. You feel like you're being pulled toward your own destiny as opposed to being pushed by other people's expectations. That can happen more than once. It can happen multiple times. So I very much advocate this idea of serial blooming. And who wouldn't be happy if they feel like they're in alignment with their deepest talents, passions, and sense of purpose, and are feeling pulled toward something that feels like a destiny that was created just for them?
Well, you mentioned that a lot of women particularly respond to this, and you can see that in the sense of because of what you just said. I don't want to get too heavy by mentioning this name, but Jean-Paul Sartre gave us a whole idea of bad faith. Too many people are doing things for the wrong reasons as opposed to for their inner life and what they need most internally. And that kind of conforms with a lot of women have been emancipated and they've been able to seek their own path.
But if you fall, but if you get on that path and you fall into this all too easy to do accepting of external pressures, then you can go down a path that isn't going to make you any happier. And that's true of men and women alike, that you can be the star student. You can go to, let's say, law school. You can work your behind off for several years to become a partner at that firm and then discover after you've crossed all those barriers and satisfied all those goals that you really didn't want to be a lawyer. And that's a common story that many of my lawyer friends tell me.
You know the old Patti Page song, is that all there is? Well, let's get some callers on board here, and let's begin with Alexandra. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I just want to say I love this conversation. I didn't hit my stride till I was 45. I'm in my early 60s. I've pretty much made a career in the nonprofit sector, which is much more forgiving, I think, than the corporate sector. And I just want to say I had a fine education. I majored in English at San Francisco State in the 1970s. And but I needed to experience life before I could gather everything that I learned. I grew up in a very alcoholic family, and I needed to process that before I could kind of figure out what my own process was. And in fact, I got married for the first time at age 60. So I'm probably the definition of a late bloomer.
Well, we certainly appreciate hearing your story. And Rich, you've heard a lot of these stories, haven't you?
Well, I have. And my heart goes out to the caller, and I applaud the caller. Certainly kids who grew up in an alcoholic family are oftentimes kids who have to take on adult responsibilities to be the adult force in the family well before they're ready. And then they end up going down a path where achieving to other people's expectations is the one they've taken on as their own. And to really bloom, you have to be able to declare independence from other people's expectations.
You talk about, and let me thank the caller, Alexander. Appreciate your call and hope the best for you. Continue on the path. That's, I guess, the best advice I could give in response to your call. And you're also talking about, well, the need for rebooting or replanting. We use a blooming metaphor here. People need to maybe find different soil. They need to find, I mean, I don't want to get carried away with this metaphor, but you also say sometimes don't be afraid of failing.
Well, I wanted to attack some of society's misguided beliefs, and one of them is that it's wrong to quit, and another one is how we deal with self-doubt. Now, this idea that quitters never win, winners never quit, I think is a half-truth. Developing the response that you're always going to quit at the first sign of adversity is a bad habit, and we all know that. But to not have quitting and repotting as part of your toolkit is to really shortchange yourself. When I think of great entrepreneurs like Richard Branson, well, Richard Branson has quit a lot of businesses, as it turns out. He quit Virgin Cola. He quit Virgin Brides.
It's funny, we have a president who's quit a lot of businesses, too, but he keeps talking about winning, and winning is everything.
Yeah, I don't think he sees it quite in the same way. But one of the iconic Silicon Valley stories was when Intel in the 1980s quit the memory chip business, even though it was their cash cow, and decided to bet it all on the microprocessor, which was not yet the profitable product that it came. And it was debated very heavily among the three founders, Andy Grove, Bob Noyce, and Gordon Moore. And at the end of the day, Andy Grove and Gordon Moore carried the day over Bob Noyce, and they got out of the memory chip business.
This is a kind of life philosophy about trial and error and the importance of recognizing that that's what life often is, especially occupation or vocation.
If you think about it this way, there's always an optimal use of your time, your talents, your money, and your sense of purpose. And you can misallocate those just as you can misallocate money in investments that go bad. And reallocate in the direction of your evolving talents, passions, purpose, and really sense of where you want to go. And they will be evolving over the course of your lifetime. I mean, neuroscience makes it very plain that the gifts that we have in our 20s, we might lose a little bit off of our fastball, but we gain a repertoire of pitches, if you want to use that kind of metaphor. Our desires, our purposes are going to change over the course of our lifetime. So to bloom multiple times, lean in the direction that you're going in.
Neural pathways change, too.
Yeah.
The only thing I've been worried about for some time is how much they're changing with kids who are looking at their devices all the time. That is yet to be seen. But let me get some more callers aboard. Here we go next to you. Rob, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. What I find a very interesting topic, and I think it's great pointing out what an ageist society, in a way, we've become. But isn't it harder and harder now with everything so expensive, with housing so expensive and different costs that are really student loans? And as soon as you land on your feet, you've got to start making as much money as possible. Do we have enough breathing room to let this happen naturally? It just seems like we're fighting a tough battle right off the bat, and there's so much pressure to jump in and be successful immediately.
Excellent point, Rob. Let's go to Rich Carlgaard and get his thoughts. Rich?
Yes, I spent about 4 years doing the research for this book, and I have to say in a couple of key areas it completely changed my previous view on an issue. And my previous view on student debt was it shouldn't be forgiven because it creates a moral hazard. Who would ever pay off a loan if they did that? And now I've come around and done a 180 on that, and I think that a lot of kids, driven by today's societal pressures and parental pressures, went to schools that they couldn't afford and majored in subjects that they didn't really feel passionate about. And here we are, a household name financier who you would never think of as being on the side of a political issue with Elizabeth Warren, who's the chief advocate for forgiving student debt, told me the $1.5 trillion of student debt, the damage that will be done in terms of the entrepreneurial companies that won't be created because creative kids feel like they have to stick with a lousy job to pay off their debt, will be a multiplier many times more than the $1.5 trillion of forgiving that student debt. And here is somebody, I'm not going to name the name of this person, but they're libertarian conservative. But I think they made the right calculus in this one.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go right to more of your calls. And let's go next to Michael. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. The comment I had is I understand that we're in a generation of instant demand and instant achievement. But how are we going to change that narrative when you've got jobs, you've got companies like Apple, Google, Genentech, IBM, and even smaller companies that require, just for an entry-level job, master's degrees, multiple bachelor's degrees. And we're forcing our generation that if you don't have these degrees, you're simply not going to get hired. And if you don't get hired, how are you going to survive? How are you going to pay your bills? And it kind of makes this self-feeding loop. Your thoughts?
Well, that's a great question. And I think you define the problem and what results very, very well. I feel like we're at the cusp of some new thinking on that, though. IBM is doing really great work here. Ginni Rometty, the CEO of IBM, is a huge advocate of their P-TECH program. Now, the P-TECH program is giving a practical education, particularly to kids from challenging economic communities. And it's kind of like a trade school that exposes these kids to computers, data science, and all of this stuff, and creates the jobs to follow. I happen to think, you know, that the excess weight that we put on SATs is just extremely discriminatory in ways that, again, I wouldn't have imagined before I set out to do the research for late bloomers.
And notwithstanding the emphasis on what Ivy League school the sheepskin is from and all that sort of thing, we now have some data that proves that it doesn't necessarily go to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, especially for white males, doesn't necessarily help them in terms of enhancing their job opportunities. We're in a different world, maybe, not only on the cusp of one, but
well,
maybe in it.
Yeah, and this gets back to the sacrifices that people make to get that kind of that piece of sheepskin.
About the scandal we just had recently.
The scandal that we just had, which is really the perverse logical conclusion of extremely affluent people doing everything they can to push their kids into a university that wouldn't otherwise accept them. But consider this. I consider one of the really bright people out there, Carol Dweck, who teaches psychology at Stanford. She wrote a best-selling book called Mindset in 2006. And I interviewed Carol Dweck, and Carol Dweck teaches an introductory class in psychology at Stanford. And she said the kids that she sees today in that class versus just 10 years ago, she's seeing kids that, in her words, are exhausted and brittle, and they don't want to mar their perfect records. Now, if that's the prize, I mean, a kid who gets into Stanford today, which, you know, 3% admissions rate, my goodness, it's an Ivy League school, unlike when I went, in a Club Med, you know, atmosphere. Kids should be jumping for joy they got into Stanford, and they're brittle and exhausted, don't want to mar their perfect records. That's saying something.
And they should have more fun,
right? They should have more fun.
Yeah, we're talking again with Rich Calgard. His book is Late Bloomers. And thanks to the listener who reminds me, boy, you always keep me on my toes, my listeners. Is that all there is was Peggy Lee, not Patty Page? If I said Patty Page, I definitely misspoke. Here's Lori who tweets, after two previous grad programs at age 53, I went to law school not to become a practicing attorney, but to get tools to become an international human rights advocate on behalf of environmental defenders. My ageless parents inspired me. And Kate writes, in my 60s now, I'm working on my first documentary film, and I'm bringing in many, many skills I've learned along the way. Ageism is real, and it's a fallacy. Deep talents align at the right time. Kelly writes, I'm the mom of a brilliant teenager who also happens to be on the autism spectrum. I know she has so much potential, but some of her executive function skills are slower to develop. Living in Silicon Valley is tough because the pressure there to do well in school at a young age, and it's assumed if you aren't on a pretty typical path toward college and beyond, then life will be tough. This conversation is very encouraging to me for those of us raising bright, neurodiverse kiddos. Let me get some more callers aboard here. And let me go next to you, Chris. Thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm hoping that I'm wondering, have you considered or would you please consider presenting your book to the state chancellor of community colleges and the Board of Governors? Because they are taking community colleges down a road, they're instituting something called Pathways. And the goal is to streamline colleges so that kids get in and get out within 2 years. They've already removed the repeatability. People can't repeat classes. So, for example, if you took a class in 1989, I just tried to enroll and got kicked off the waiting list for a class I took in 1989 for screenwriting. Yeah.
Well, what about this? You want to turn your book over to the chancellor of the community colleges?
Well, I would love to have a conversation with whoever with whoever will have me, whether it's school administrators or talking to employers about age diversity in the workforce. And there's some real institutional barriers about that. Look, I'm glad that I could repeat a class that I flunked. Well, I didn't flunk. I got a low C the first time I took calculus, and then I took it over and was able to replace it with an A minus, a low A.
It's an achievement to be proud of.
Yeah, well, something to be proud of, but it was a real lift for me. I think that the community college system is, you know, is a jewel. It's a jewel throughout the country. It's one of the great things that the state of California did. I mean, the whole California system, from the UCs to community colleges to the state universities, is such a wonderful spectrum that provides so many opportunities for neurodiverse kids. I hope that we don't ruin it.
There's a listener who writes, CEOs give answers claiming that they value traits like curiosity because they are political answers that help their PR image. Give me a break.
There may be some truth to that, but when you look at what, remember that old cliche that the A students will end up working for the B students? And it's basically, what is meant by that is that the B students are the ones that are going to go into sales or something like that. They have other attributes that are not perhaps captured by STEM-based courses. And you have to be curious. If you don't have the STEM degree that offers you the clear path with the technology company, then you're going to have to be curious. You're going to have to stay in touch. Look, I want, you know, with all the companies that I've ever worked for, all the people that I've ever managed, I want the people who are reading widely. I remember I spent time with on the road with Bill Gates when he was a far different person than he is now. He's this very circumspect global philanthropist. And he was just a really switched on character. He had this wonderful sarcasm. But he was he was a voracious reader. I remember flying.
Still is, actually.
Yeah. And he's got a great book club. But I remember we're sitting on a Delta shuttle flight from Boston to LaGuardia. And it was half empty. And there, Bill Gates is working on his 486 laptop computer. And perched atop his laptop computer was a book called The Intelligent Investor that Warren Buffett had given him. Now, think about that. Warren Buffett giving Bill Gates a book on investment. But Gates was not just reading the book. He was doing the calculations in the book on his computer. And that's the kind of person I found Gates to be. He was curious about a wide range of fields, not just the various divisions and departments at Microsoft at the time, but a wide range. And it served him extremely well.
They also say, you hear CEOs say that they value thinking outside of the box, although a lot of them like pretty much obedience and not necessarily going afar when it comes to thinking in the culture that they're in. But what do you think about the idea that you hear from many, it's a kind of prejudice about people as they get older, they're less capable of thinking outside the box?
Well, I think that needs to be challenged. I'll go back to L. Conan Goldberg, who the NYU neuroscientist, admittedly a controversial figure, that thinks that our creative insight gets better as we get older. Now, he acknowledges that young people have more raw creativity. If you take an 8-year-old to Disneyland and watch their minds being filled with things they had never seen, you know, they're being flooded with creative thoughts. This idea of creative insight is you have the ability to perceive something novel, and then it travels along these neural pathways to the logical side of your brain, the side where your memories are stored. And then this novel insight is paired up with what you already know, and out pops this creative insight. And so you have more to compare your novel perceptions to. So he thinks that we get a better yield from our creativity as we get older, even if we have fewer creative, raw creative moments.
Bigger storehouse of knowledge, bigger frame of reference.
Yeah.
Rich Carlgaard is our guest, and his book is called Late Bloomers. And let me read a couple comments. Ellie writes, don't forget that a lot of people, especially women, are under pressure to have families and take care of young children through their 20s, 30s, and early 40s. Women often have no choice but to reinvent ourselves professionally later in life after the kids are a little older. And Michael writes, I was mocked by my last manager for taking too long to graduate college. Now I'm with a different company and making more money with the skills I learned from my previous job. Let me get some more calls on, and let's go next to you.
Love it when the good guys win.
Yeah, I like that, too, for the same reason. Scott, you're on. Good to
Good morning. Scott here. I'm 50 years old. My wife and I were married when we were 23 and got a great opportunity to go teach high school in East Africa for a little over a year. And it was a very difficult experience and amazing experience. And I just wanted to encourage anybody really wants to take a gap in their education or takes a gap in their life to go over to a developing nation or any nation for that matter and teach just basic skills. And, you know, it makes everything here in the United States look great. First of all, this is a great country and it's worth investing in and working for. But it also makes everything seem like gravy here. I'm pretty confident I could live in a tin can and be satisfied, because all of this, most of this that we live in, is optional. So if you've got a year to take a gap in your life or in your education, go over and teach basic skills overseas. Real rewarding experience, and that's something that you truly learn to be grateful for in the second half of life. So, well, great conversation. Y'all have a great week.
Yeah, thank you, Scott, for that. Appreciate your point of view. And let's go right to another caller. That's Ashay in Oakland. Good morning.
Good morning. Excuse me. Let me know if I need to speak up. My voice is going out a little bit. So I love this conversation. I have to admit, a lot of conversations like these are a bit frustrating to me because I'm 40 years old. I've been living knowing exactly what you all are saying for my whole life, but without anyone getting it. And then so I really appreciate that nowadays, pretty much with everything, all these conversations are really addressing a lot of the I guess, non-traditional ways of thinking. But so right now I'm 40 years old. I'm at UC Berkeley for my undergraduate degree. I'm neurodivergent, but basically the main thing I wanted to say is I was able to navigate and live according to what I felt was either drawing me or just not doing what someone said I had to do, because I had I was seen as gifted. I was seen as mature. And because of that, I was able to navigate through what people might have tried to discourage me from or shaming me for not doing what looked like the more successful thing. And a lot of times it was because of how I communicate. It was because I was quote unquote smart. And again, kind of mature for my age. And I also learned early on that when I would share what I was going to do, which was not comfortable for other people, there was a lot of discouragement. There was a lot of craziness. But when I wouldn't share, let's say I just went ahead and did something and then was successful at it, they don't even realize that they would have discouraged me from it. But because I was successful at it, then they're like, oh, that's so great. More people should be like you, and da-da-da-da. People need to. So I really feel like our society has myopic views on so many things, and it is exactly what you said about basically what came from industrialization, that idea that the system is what we're all stuck in, and individuals can't really just navigate on their own.
Well, I appreciate your perspective, Ashay. Good to hear from you. Thank you. Do you want to say something here,
yeah,
Ruth?
I think we're still living in Frederick Taylor's world. In fact, we may even be returning it into unproductive ways with the reliance we have on data today. Look, my formative sport growing up was track and field. And what I love about track and field, men and women's track, is you have everything from sprinters to weight throwers to pole vaulters to marathon runners, middle distance runners. Now, suppose you're the world's most gifted potential marathon runner, but along comes a test that everybody's going to grade you on, and that test happens to be the shot put. You know, what a crime it would be to judge that potential marathon runner on how well they threw the shot put. And yet, that's what I feel like so many kids and adults are subject to today. They're being graded along somebody else's metric that doesn't even begin to touch their natural skills and sense of purpose.
So, question a little off the mark here. Would you rather be out there running on the track or flying up in the air? Because I know you're a pilot.
Yeah, man. Yeah. If I could still run, I would love to be running. But now I bike because I break down injury too quickly.
Let me read a couple comments. Christina writes, there is social pressure to succeed at a young age, but our definitions of success change as we grow older. Peaking is an interesting way of putting it. I think we experience many peaks and valleys throughout our careers and personal lives, so I try to focus on each thing as it comes. And Brian says, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. The climb of success feels like a cage if you can't step back sometimes and see where you are going. Yeah, smell the roses, right? Here's Wanda. Wanda, join us. Hi. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Jenna. Jenna, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I shared something with Rich. I think I was the dumbest person at Stanford when I went there. But I wanted to share a story about recreating oneself. and that is after 35 years of teaching a classroom English class, I decided to try to write some poetry and find my voice, and I was named the Poet Laureate of San Ramon and given a one-year sabbatical to study poetry at St. Mary's College, where they don't have age discrimination. My experience and thought and love of language gave me a scholarship. So just wanted to encourage listeners out there that maybe there's another opportunity. I'm 58 and a half, and I'm still learning and still trying to find something great.
Well, that's an inspiring call. Congratulations to you over at St. Mary's College with Robert Haas and company, Poet Laureate. Thoughts, final thoughts from you, Rich? We're going to come to the end of the hour here to encourage people, inspire people again.
I want to say a little bit about self-doubt, because if you're a late bloomer, you probably have more than your share of self-doubt. Well, first of all, everybody has self-doubt. Meryl Streep talks about self-doubt quite a bit. She's quoted it in the book. If you can learn to deal with your self-doubt and move forward, then you'll have a huge advantage as you seek to live a life where you can bloom multiple times.
Well, good blooming, and thank you so much for being with us. Rich Calgard is again the publisher of Forbes and the author of Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and gratitude for your being with us. Hope you will be with us on the morrow. We should be back on Forum again tomorrow morning, live at 9 o'clock after the news. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.